From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 429 for this February the 10th, 2013. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And I have a story to tell you today about an experience I had with an insurance company. A patient of mine, close to 50, went to his insurance company looking for life insurance, and in an excellent illustration of why we should not be doing tests on healthy people without clear evidence that the test is actually beneficial for detecting disease and preventing disease, it has been a good illustration as well for my medical student that is at our practice right now for the next 3 or 4 weeks to illustrate why insurance companies, frankly, I think, do a lot of these tests to reject people outright. So here's the story. So it's a gentleman, as I said, about 50 years old, healthy, nothing wrong with him. I've seen him before in the past, have done the routine screening on him that has evidence for his age. That is, the only thing he needed was cholesterol and blood sugar levels, and those have been normal in the past. But the insurance company decides to do blood work again. And they also have someone go to his home, a nurse go to his home, and do an electrocardiogram. You know, an electrocardiogram is the stuff with the wires that attach to your chest, and it checks heart rate and potential for enlarged hearts or arrhythmias and so on. Not a great test to do for screening in someone who is otherwise healthy. In fact, it's absolutely useless to do in someone who is otherwise healthy and has a D recommendation, D meaning not recommended at all because there's no evidence, from both the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force and the Canadian Periodic Health Exam Task Force that both look at these and say, you don't do this to people who are otherwise healthy. And why don't you do this? Well, for exactly the reason why this gentleman experienced this particular problem. I get an electrocardiogram result back from the insurance company instructing me that I should be sending this patient to see a cardiologist to rule out the possibility that he may have had a heart attack. Now remember, this is a 50-year-old man who has had no symptoms at all, who is otherwise healthy and active, who has never had chest pain, who has never had anything in his life, and now is being told on the basis of a flimsy electrocardiogram done at home that somehow he may have had a heart attack. And so they reject his insurance claim, his insurance application, on the basis of this and say, well, you can resubmit if you can show that this isn't anything. So now the public health system has to deal with the insurance company's test in order to show that in the end, this is a false positive result. So in effect, what we have is turning a healthy person, and this goes along the lines for a lot of screening tests that we do that shouldn't be done, that turns an otherwise healthy person into a patient because now he wants to get his insurance. And I've been given a result that I have to now disprove for the sake of my patient and also to take this mark off his record because now this is part of the insurance company's general record that he may have had a heart attack. So I have to send him to a cardiologist now who will likely have to do a whole bunch of other tests. Some of them may be invasive. Some of them may require radioactive dye. Some, who knows what the cardiologist may want to do to ensure that that first electrocardiogram done was a false positive. This, to me, is professionally and ethically repugnant to have subjected my patient to something that he should never have had to been subjected to, all on the basis of a company doing outdated tests using outdated recommendations to literally screen away people from getting insurance. That's how that's the only conclusion I can come to, right? They're doing a test. There's no evidence for doing that test on a healthy person. He's given a history to the insurance company that he has not had any heart disease. He didn't even have a cardiac exam by the company itself, even though the EKG showed that there was something wrong, but no one examined him. And yet on the basis of a test that may or may not have been done properly, he's now branded and can be branded for life. But the Public Health Service, OHIP, now has to cover the cost because I have to send him to the cardiologist in order to ensure that he is insurable. And it goes to a broader point as well, and I've talked about this before, that screening, going into your physician's office and asking for specific tests may or may not be the correct action. There are specific things that are done, specific screening evaluations that are done for specific age groups at particular times in a person's life, depending on family history and other health circumstances, where the screening will be a valuable tool. But in other situations, the screening will be absolutely useless. And it will turn otherwise healthy people, as I mentioned before, into patients who then can suffer harm. And this has been seen over and over again. In fact, there is a report, Consumer Reports actually did something for their readership. They tapped the database from the American College of Physicians and the Annals of Internal Medicine and the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. And the questions that they wanted to answer for their readership was, what are the most effective screening tests and what are the ones to avoid? And the most effective tests are ones we've discussed on the show, one of them being for cervical cancer that starts doing a Pap test, starting at age 21 and repeating this every 3 years or so if the tests are normal, and it runs from age 21 to 65 years of age. Breast cancer screening from age 50 to 74 years of age, with consideration given to family history. If there is a family history of breast cancer in a first-degree relative, mother or sister, before the age of 50, you may want to screen earlier. But 50 to 74 every 2 years or so is considered to be the norm. Colon cancer screening also was high on the list for men and women from 50 to 75 years of age. Usually we do a colonoscopy. Some people do a stool test looking for blood. I find the colonoscopy is much more accurate and gives a better reflection on that screening. But the other tests that are discouraged with regards to screening, bladder cancer by doing a urine test, lung cancer by doing low-dose CT scans, oral cancers, a healthcare professional such as a dentist should carry out a routine visual exam of the mouth. It should be done as normal routine oral care and not as a screening test. Ovarian cancer is the lowest rating for females of all ages because it's not very effective in doing any screening for that. Prostate cancer, as we mentioned, PSA tests. I inform my patients that PSA tests for otherwise healthy men with no symptoms will cause more harm in more healthy men than save lives in men who have prostate cancer. Pancreatic cancer, no evidence for screening. Skin cancer should be carried out yearly by a dermatologist or your family doctor. And for testicular cancer in young men, screened. Only men at high risk should be considered for testicular cancer screening because the majority of the cancers, even if they're found later on, are detected without screening, are curable. So I just wanted to bring this up to you to let you understand that screening and testing and blood tests and all the things that are available to everybody is not necessarily what's going to keep you well, and that it should be individually based. There should be personalized medicine so that for your given age and your history, only specific things to be done and not blanketing you or carpet bombing you with particular tests. We're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we'll come back with your calls, 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, back in just a couple of minutes.
Advil has a candy coating. It's delicious. And it says right on the bottle, do not have more than two. Well, then do not put a candy coating around it. For I cannot help myself.
Mrs. Simpson, I'm afraid your husband is dead. April Fool's. He's very much alive, although I'm afraid he may never walk again.
Mr. Evil.
Dr. Evil. I didn't spend 6 years in evil medical school to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
Remember my motto, laughter is the best medicine, you know? And unless you're a diabetic. And then, insulin.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call. Your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255. Or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Now warning lights are flashing down in quality control. Somebody threw a spanner, they threw him in the hole. There's rumors in the Logan Bay and anger in the town. Somebody blew the whistle and the walls came down. There's a meeting in the boardroom, they're trying to trace the smell. There's a leaking in the washroom, there's a sneaking personnel. Somewhere in the corridor, someone was heard to sneeze. Goodness me, could this be industrial disease?
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And going to the phones and line one. Good afternoon to Trish in Ottawa.
Oh, hi, doctor.
Hi.
I'm 77 and I was taking Crestor, but I came off it when it started giving me severe muscle pains.
Mm-hmm.
So I take 1 milligram of Nabilone for the pain. The dose is 2, but my stomach won't tolerate 2. So mm-hmm. I still have the pain, not as bad as before, though. I started having treatment 3 times a week with an ultrasound machine, but they only treat the bottom of my neck, not the shoulder blades and the shoulders where the pain is. In your opinion, doctor, is this correct? And are there any side effects with this treatment? Can it be used for arthritis of the knees? And I'm sorry to be asking you all this, but I've only had a couple of treatments and I've only just thought about all these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ultrasound is used as a means of trying to relax the muscle, sometimes warm up the muscle and stretch it out. I think it's a valid question that you asked regarding whether it should be used on other areas of the shoulder when there are other areas that are painful. And so there certainly is no contraindication to using it on other areas. The main thing is to ask them their clinical reasoning why they're not, right? So especially if you have pain in that area. So that would be the first thing to ask them. The second is that usually if a medication has caused muscle pain and damage, cessation of that medication should reverse things completely. So if you have continued pain, and is the pain in one area only? Like, is that muscle pain primarily just in the shoulder?
Well, it starts in the arms. It's in the morning when I wake up, doctor, and then in mm-hmm. my shoulder, and then in my shoulder blade and across the back. And you and my own doctor thought it was PMR. But after 3 blood tests last year, they all shown up negative.
Okay.
So.
But there are other evaluations that can be done to look and see if the muscle was damaged. There is a test that's called the 2 letters that are used are called CK, or creatinine kinase. And this, if the muscle has been damaged, this level will be elevated. It's one way to see if there's muscle that's damaged.
Well, what happened, doctor, I phoned you last summer.
Yes.
I came off it then, and I was on the Sesame and the Voltaire, and
yes.
I did great all summer. And the doctor said with me blood work, you've either got to go back on it, take the consequences. I went back on it for 2 weeks, and I was in so much agony. He put me on 50 milligrams a day of prednisone for 2 weeks. So that's why I really think it was that. And I don't know how it's lasting so long. It's been 13 months now, on and off with this thing.
Yeah, that's the mystery, because usually it is reversible damage. What other evaluations have been done on your shoulder?
I went to see a rheumatologist, but she just told me to lift my arms up, and she wanted to give me a cortisone injection, and I didn't want one, but I was outnumbered because my daughter was with me, so I had it. It didn't have no effect at all.
So
I've had nothing else. I don't know where else to go, doctor.
Okay. Now, you said you're using the Nabilone, which says upsetting your stomach. Yeah, the Sesame.
Yeah.
And anti-inflammatories, again, you have to be careful careful using them because, especially for Voltaren or diclofenac or any of the anti-inflammatories in older individuals, because it can cause harm over time, potentially to kidneys and to the stomach. So you have to be careful.
Yeah.
There are also, if we're looking at now just isolating what to do with regards to the pain, there are topical agents that can be used. I don't know if you've used them yet, that can be applied on the surface of the skin that can penetrate into the area and provide you with some pain relief.
Only the Voltaren, doctor, which does that.
Right. And has that been helpful at all?
Yes, very helpful.
Okay, so that's good. But there is, and what I will do is at the break, after we finish the call, I'll put you on hold because there is a compounding pharmacy in town that also does a combination of medications in a base that'll penetrate through the skin as well that may provide you with even better pain relief.
That'd be great.
So I'll give you that off the air because I don't want to give any necessary advantage to anyone,
I understand.
One or the other. The ultrasound really won't help arthritis of the knee.
No.
And the reason is that it's different structure. It's the bone that's inflamed. The ultrasound won't have any effect on the degradation of the cartilage that has occurred on the joint surfaces.
Yeah.
But I think right now, Trish, the issue is the rheumatologist didn't give you any diagnosis either, did they? Did they say
no,
anything?
She sent blood work off again. I said, I've had it done twice, and for PMR. I said, it's negative. But she said, well, I'll just send another one off. And, of course, that came back negative. So all this money wasted.
Now, have you had an ultrasound of the neck and shoulder to see if there have been any tears?
Yeah.
And no tears were shown?
No.
Okay. So.
But this ultrasound machine that they're doing the treatment on me now, they say they're doing it just at the top of my neck because that's where it will send, help all the nerves going across my shoulders and down my arms.
That probably isn't correct.
And they said it will also form red blood cells.
It's not going to form red blood cells.
No.
So the
I didn't think that.
Yeah, I'm glad you're skeptical,
come to the
Trish.
House, doctor. They're very good.
Yeah,
they come to the house and it pays for it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're being skeptical in some ways because the ultrasound, you know, I've had ultrasound done on my arms and on my leg when I had injured myself.
Yeah.
And the ultrasound has to be applied for sometimes 5 or 10 minutes. It's moved over the area and over the specific area that hurts. So if you have other areas that hurt, the ultrasound should be going there as well. There's no radiation of effect from the ultrasound other than where it is other than the area that's directly lying
where
under
it's placed.
It. Yeah.
Well, I thought that myself.
Yeah.
And I did ask the guy that did it.
Yeah. And I think it's unfortunate they're telling you that it improves red blood cells and that it improves the nerves. It doesn't do anything of the sort. It's designed to work on the muscle, to relax the muscle, alleviate some pain, but it's not something that affects those particular areas. That is, you know.
Okay.
But what I do think, Trish, in the interim, I think it's important that you be as comfortable as possible because if the pain is impairing your ability to function, then we should do something to alleviate that, but try to also minimize side effects from medications and avoid, if we can, oral medications, which can, over time, lead to even more side effects.
Yeah.
So what I'll do, Trish, is I will put you on hold.
Okay.
And once we get to the news break, I'll let Dave know what the name of the pharmacy is, and then that way you can speak to your physician about getting that done.
Okay, that would be great.
All
Thank
right.
you very much,
you're,
doctor.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. We're going to go to line two, and Alberta in Stittsville. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Dorgan. I've been diagnosed with shingles about 10 days ago.
Okay.
And the doctor put me on the antiviral and Lyrica at 50 mg 3 times a day.
Okay.
And I seem to have quite a bit of pain, especially at night.
Right.
Is 50 mg 3 times a day, is that it's a low dosage, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a smaller dose. The maximum dose for Lyrica or pregabalin is the generic name or the medication name. You can go up to almost, 300 milligrams twice a day or up to 600 milligrams a day. So it usually is increased slowly because it can cause drowsiness as one of its side effects. When you were treated for shingles, how many days had you had the rash before you were given the antiviral medication?
It was about 12 hours because it started out with pain in my right side around the rib cage, and I just thought it was a sports injury. But I'd say within 12 hours after the
rash. Well, that's good. So I'm glad it was started. The time to treat shingles is usually within the first 3 days of having symptoms, so that's good. So what I would say, Alberta, is certainly speak to your physician before you increase the dose, because I cannot advise you to do that. I haven't examined you. So you have to speak to your physician about increasing the dose to try and control that pain.
So what would be a good dose
It's titrated according to response. So usually you go up in 25 milligram increments. So you'd go 75, 50, 75, then 75, 75, 75. It would be slowly increased. So your physician would be able to give you the prescriptions in order to do that.
Okay.
We have to break for the news, Alberta, but I'll put you on hold, okay?
Okay, thank you.
And we'll take a small break for the news. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, back with all your calls in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
And back to the phone lines. We'll finish up our phone call with Alberta. Now, Alberta, you had one other question.
Okay. I also take extra strength Tylenol to relieve the pain.
Yes.
Is that okay to take? I realize there's a maximum on it.
No, you can use that in combination. That will help. The other thing to consider as well for pain, especially if the pain is on the skin and really, really bothering you, is you can also use topical agents, topical painkillers or gels that might be helpful. Just as our previous caller mentioned that they were using the Voltaren gel to put on the skin, which is diclofenac, that might be helpful. It's safer to do that on the skin because you get very little absorption into your body, and that in combination with the other things might be helpful. There are also other topical agents, sometimes topical anesthetic medications that contain xylocaine in them. There are some creams and gels that are available that can be put directly on the skin, can also help alleviate the pain. So you may want to speak to your physician about those too.
Is one Neutrogen, is that one of the ones? Or
The xylocaine stuff is just called Visca. There's something called Emla cream, which is a topical anesthetic that's used for the skin. There's also, like I said, the Voltaren Emol gel.
That's okay.
And so I would discuss that with your physician first with regards to using something like that to see if that helps alleviate some of the pain.
Okay, because it won't interfere with my arthritis medication.
Correct. I mean, that's the thing, is that if you're using topical agents, you have less chance of it interacting with anything that you're taking by mouth.
Okay, I'm one of the ones that can't get the shingles shots, so I could get shingles again. Is that correct?
It's possible. Usually if you've had shingles this time, your body has built up some antibodies to it, so it may prevent you over the short term from getting shingles again.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for your help.
You're very welcome, Alberta.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 521 Talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long distance number. And over to line 5 and Don in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Hello, Don, are you there?
Yes, hi, Doctor.
Hi.
You're back. When are you back on again? Tuesday or Wednesday in the afternoon?
Wednesday, yes.
Wednesday? Okay, because I'll have to phone back with another question on Wednesday.
Sure.
I'm going to switch my question, if you don't mind here.
Sure.
It's 2 years ago, I had oral cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given the choice between surgery and radiation.
Okay.
How I was supposed to make an informed decision within 48 hours. That's what I was told. You choose, tell us, and we'll move on from here. So I chose radiation.
Okay.
And So after since then, I've had a few. By the way, I've been cleared a couple of times on my regular checkups that the cancer is gone.
Good.
But you know, since the treatment, well, this problem has only started after that. If I get into a bit of a coughing spell, I totally black out, fall down, bang my head, knock myself unconscious a couple of times from these coughing spells.
Right.
So finally, after about 11 months, I got my MRI. Because I don't know if it's related to the radiation, you know, it was in the bottom of the floor of my mouth. So I had an MRI and, through this whole process, I was not allowed to see my MRI. Is that wrong?
You should be allowed to see your MRI and also see the written report.
I was, the neurologist, basically went over the written report.
Yeah.
And I was told, no, the neurologist doesn't even get the MRI.
Well, they can. I mean, there are ways to get access. Some, depending on whether they have affiliations with the hospital, if the MRI was done at the hospital, you can log on and link into what's called their PACS system, P-A-C-S, and you can literally see all the stuff that was done and all the slices of the MRI, x-rays, anything diagnostic, blood work, history, hospital admissions, all that stuff is available online. They have to have access to it, and they can print up the information. You can't print up the photographs or the images of the MRI because of just the size of the files, and it just wouldn't print up very well on a regular printer. But that is usually available, depending on whether they have access to the university, the hospital files.
Yeah, well, I did a lot of homework. I went to the library. I studied the brain. I was hoping to see my amygdala, and I learned an awful lot to find out about it. And the written report says there was they found two white spots.
Right.
And that's as far, and it ended right there.
Yeah, this is again the problem of doing. And you should be able to see the pictures if you want to. I mean, one of the ways to do that too is you can even go to the hospital and request the images to be put on a CD and you can take it home. Now I know that if you request it, they will charge you for it. If your physician requests the CD, then you will not have to pay for it. It'll be sent to your physician's office, and they can certainly make a copy for you. So that's one way around that as well.
Okay. Now, is this the couple of things that I've told you about? Is this related to these two things? My neck will, whenever every 2 months or so, go paralyzed. It'll pull my side of my face down.
Right.
It'll totally lock up for about 20 seconds or so, and I just.
It's almost like a cramp that's going on in there from the radiation damage and the tissue that's been damaged. But Don, what you're describing though with regards to the loss of consciousness and coughing, the fancy term for this is called cough-induced syncope. Syncope means a fainting spell. And ideally I would say that the radiation treatment is not the first thing on the list that I would think of as being the cause of this.
Right.
There are two areas that need to be evaluated. One is your respiratory tract to see if there's any inflammation or damage that could be leading to the cough, because sometimes severe cough in and of itself can cause a nerve reflex action that can cause you to faint. So that's the first step. The second is also to have a cardiac exam done to see a cardiologist because you are fainting, to see if the coughing itself is inducing any changes in the heart or causing any change in rhythms that can lead to your fainting or drops in blood pressure. So those are the two areas that I would investigate, given that you are falling unconscious, and that's a pretty serious thing.
I was out for 20 minutes.
Yeah, and so that's not a good thing, and this is not something that you should wait on. I would see your physician this week and say you're having, and literally say, I'm having cough-induced syncope, and that this needs to be evaluated by both a respirologist and a cardiologist in order to try and determine the mechanism that is leading to this condition, because that is very dangerous for you, especially if you're doing anything, if you're driving and you have a coughing fit and you fall unconscious. So, you know, who wants to even think about stuff like that?
Yeah. Syncope, S-Y-N-C-O-P-Y?
S-Y-N-C-O-P-E.
C-O-P-E.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's the step I would take in your discussion with your physician, because, again, unconscious for 20 minutes, hitting your head on the ground. I mean, there's all kinds of things that can happen.
Yeah, well, it's I'm terrified of going to some certain places.
Yeah, I don't blame you at all. And that's why I think this needs to be urgently looked at, because if this is happening relatively frequently for you, your health is in danger.
And I'll just have to ask my family doctor to, as far as my neck going paralyzed and stuff.
Yeah,
I'll ask her to try and do something else for me.
Yeah, I would ask them to take a look and see what's going on in that area. Absolutely. But I think your main issue right now is the fainting spells.
Yeah. Because I had one of those temporary paralysis thing halfway through the MRI.
Right.
So I thought, Jesus, this is great. This might help them see something or whatever.
It only shows anatomy in that area of the brain, so it probably didn't do much with regards to the neck at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Don, I wish you the best.
Okay, I'll give you a call later on this week about my mom.
All right.
Thanks.
All the best. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. We have Don in Stittsville, who would like to talk about a rash he got while in hospital, and Margaret in Ottawa would like to talk about Splenda. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back with your calls in just a few minutes.
Liability waiver.
Don't read it, just sign it. It simply says you won't hold us responsible if you die as a result of gross negligence. It's a standard form.
I've been trying to swim a lot, you know. You always hear swimming's the best exercise, but have you seen how fat whales are? Whales, they're like swimming all the time.
It's not working, whales.
Wouldn't it be great if we found out whales were in complete denial about how huge they are, though?
It's mostly water weight.
Before you even consider this, I insist you consult a doctor.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call. News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
A hot summer night, feel like a net. I've got to find my baby yet. I need you to soothe my head. Turn my blue heart to red.
And back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Don in Stittsville.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hi, Don.
I've been listening to you for years, but I guess it's my turn.
All right, well, thank you.
I was involved in a serious accident last October, and I was in a local hospital where they put all my bones back together.
Oh, boy.
And when I was leaving there, I noticed I was getting a bit itchy, and it reminded me of when I was in the hospital 40 years ago. I had the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they shipped me to this other hospital to try to build up my muscles and things again. And, God, I get itches on my back and on my arms and the lower part of my legs. And in inquiring in the hospital, there was other people that had the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I asked the doctor about it, and he said, oh, well, I'll send the nurse down with some lotion. Well, this happened 3 or 4 times. And I had to apply the lotion myself, which is very hard to do on the back.
Yes, no kidding.
Plus, I got a nurse to do it one night, and she must have taken all of 5 seconds to do it.
Right.
And now I'm home. I've been home now for a week, and my body is still covered with this rash and itch. Have you heard anything about this?
So does it include your face and neck, or is it everything below the neck?
Everything below the neck.
Okay. And is it more so on areas, for example, chest, under your arms, along your waist, in those areas? Where does the rash tend to be the worst?
On my back.
Okay.
And on my upper arms.
Okay. So what this likely is and what this sounds like, given that it's all over the place, is something that we call a contact dermatitis.
Yes.
Meaning that something that was applied to your skin or something that has been touching your skin has caused this inflammation and rash. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely to be a disease process in terms of an infection because you would see very clear types of characteristics for it to be an infection. You know, usually you get it gets very hot and red and you get discharge
or things like that.
And so what we have to wonder is, in the hospital, were the soaps that were used or the detergents that were used for the gowns something that irritated your skin? Were the bed sheets washed with a particular soap or detergent that has irritated your back?
Right.
Because, again, we have to ask, why is it on a certain area of your body more so than others?
Right on. Right?
Because if it was an infection or if it was, it just doesn't happen where you get this one area that gets worse than all the others. And so that's what would make me think that there's something that your skin was exposed to that you were allergic to.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
So the idea now is to stay away from anything that has a scent to it when you're washing your skin. So for any soaps that you use, any detergents that you're using, you want it to be unscented. Same thing for shampoos, to be unscented, because the scent itself represents various alcohols that give you odor, and it can also irritate the skin. It can also embed itself into clothing, and so when you lie down and you start to sweat, you know, you're in a hospital bed and your back is against the bed sheets, you start to sweat, and it can drag things out of the material onto your back.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is going on, Donna. Ideally, you'd want to see this followed. Certain cortisone type creams can help alleviate that, but obviously you need someone to help put that stuff on your back.
Oh yes, of course.
To help alleviate it, but also I would wash everything that you have in stuff that doesn't have perfumes. Like I said, a lot of detergents have that in there, and even though they may not have caused you any harm in the past, the point is that your back is now itchy and red, and so you don't want to have anything potentially irritating it further.
My wife has been very good. She's been doing what you said.
Okay.
She washes everything. Every night she washes my back.
Right.
And tries a lotion or two different things on it. And nothing has worked so far.
Now, remember, you want to use, when you wash your back, you want to use something that's not going to take all the oil out of your back. So again, for the soaps, there are certain soaps that are out there that can be used. They don't lather up, but they certainly can help. They certainly will wash your back, but not irritate it. And so there's lots of those in the pharmacy that you can find. I would do those kind of things in order to, again, minimize the discomfort. The other type of lotion that can be put on the back is anything that contains urea, U-R-E-A, urea.
Yes.
And usually anywhere between 10 to 20% urea. There's a whole bunch of different products out there that have that.
Yes.
And that also can help moisturize your skin
and
alleviate some of that discomfort.
Well, that's very good.
All right, Don. Well, I hope this helps you out.
I hope it does, too.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All the best to you. Bye-bye now. And over to line 4, and good afternoon to Margaret in Ottawa.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
Dr. Dworkin. Dr. Dworkin, I know that you have said in the past that you are in favor of Splenda. We've got three friends that are literally death against it. And is it a case of using too much that's not good for you? Or we kind of use it minimally, but I'd sure like a professional opinion on this.
Sure. I think that they are over-exaggerating its harms. Splenda is made of essentially sucralose. Sucralose is a sugar molecule called sucrose that has substituted on it 3 chlorine atoms. So chlorine, and so what happens when you do that is that it's not absorbed. There are absolutely no studies, and in terms of the approval process, there has been nothing to suggest that Splenda causes any harm at all because it's just simply not absorbed. It goes right through you. It's 600 times more sweet than regular sugar, and as a result, you need to use very little of it to give you the sweet flavor.
Right. Right.
What's found in Splenda is also things like maltodextrin and other carbohydrates that sort of fluff it up and make it look more like sugar to be used when you sprinkle it on. But those are found in tons of other products. So these are things that have been around for 40 or 50 years. So again, the issue is, I think people tend to read what they want to read on the internet. They have a certain belief system about what sweeteners will do, and they sort of include sweeteners into all one category instead of looking to see exactly how they're made and what they're actually composed of. So in this case, I would say Splenda is not going to do any harm to you. In fact, for the most part, real sugar is going to be more harmful in terms of all the calories and the extra calories that we don't need versus Splenda, which is certainly much more reduced in calorie content.
Well, that's what that was sort of my thinking was, okay, it's still on the market. It's, you know, we're not hearing enough about it. And if it wasn't good for you, I was sure that they wouldn't be putting it in all the foods and everything that it's in.
Well, that's right. There is an approval process. So, you know, there's no conspiracy. It's simply a matter of if you want to use it, you can use it for the same reason that, you know, when you look at aspartame, which is another type of sweetener, the cutoff for potential theoretical harm to people is if you drink approximately 80 cans of soda a day. So it just gives you an idea of, you know, how much you would have to ingest in terms of aspartame to cause harm. And with regards to sucralose, again, it's just a sugar atom, a sugar molecule that has been slightly changed so that it's not absorbed. So in fact, it doesn't even go into your body in terms of into your bloodstream. It goes right through your intestine and you just, you know, out it comes at the end.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Margaret.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now. And my apologies to Pat in Ottawa. She wanted to comment on a call that we had, I think, with Don calling and his cough-induced syncope, but we are just about out of time. We only have about 30 seconds left in the show. My thanks to Dave for producing Sunday House Call and your calls as always. Next week, Dr. Ben Goldacre will be on discussing his book, Bad Pharma. I will be announcing this from the rooftops for the next week because you don't want to miss what he has to say. And as cliched as that is, it will totally change your view of how the pharmaceutical industry promotes its drugs, how they're tested, and literally how things go awry. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.